What's up, everybody? If you guys are a skincare, cosmetics, in that industry, this is an episode for you. We talked to the chief digital officer at Beekman 1802, David Baker. Fascinating episode. We get a lot into what is capital B brand, especially at a brand like that. Actually, he was a client. This gets a little spicy. The conversation is totally cordial and everything, but it is a little spicy in the sense that this is first episode where this is a former client that has now left us, and we get into exactly why and how that happened. So we get into that, and overall, just a great perspective on if you're a brand, like I said, in the skincare cosmetic space, and you're wanting to do influencer marketing right, how to think about it, what they're doing, comparing yourselves to Beekman 1802, trying to find a different angle or benefit. This is an exciting one. Let's jump in. Want to shout out and thank our sponsors here on the Influence Marketing Blueprint podcast, Social Snowball and Mighty Scout, both tools that we use internally and recommend highly to D2C brands that are wanting to leverage influence marketing and paid social and creative. Go check them out. This guy's about to blow up. All right. We are back with another episode of the Influence Marketing Blueprint. Taylor, what's up?
How we doing?
Co-pilot. We're back in the driver's seat together. And we have a fascinating guest, word out on the street. It's only his second podcast that he's been on. So if you're catching him early before his rise to fame, then this is the show that you did it on. David, how are we doing?
Good. Doing good. It's, you know, it's September. It's where T-minus a few days before Q4. So that definitely keeps me up at night. But doing well overall. How about yourself, Cody? How are you doing, Taylor?
David Baker. Not David Beekman, which I wanted to call you. You are much more than the brand that you work at. So why don't you give the audience a little, but I did just tease the brand. I'm going to give the audience a little bit of background on who you are, how you came to Beekman, 1802, I'm cutting it short, and your rise to that brand.
And to this podcast.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. That's fair too. As Cody said, my name is David Baker. I am currently the Chief Digital Officer at Beekman 1802. We are a skincare brand focusing on both facial and body skincare, available as an omnichannel brand. We sell on QVC, HSN. We're available nationwide at Ulta and every Ulta Target now as of this month, as well as .com and Amazon. I've been at Beekman for about a year. That's not where I got my start, so we'll flash back. I got my start working on political campaigns. I walked onto a political campaign wanting to be a field organizer, wanting to knock on doors and ultimately become a campaign manager. And my campaign manager, her name was Jessie, pointed at me and said, "Hey, you, kid with a MacBook, do for us what Obama's doing." And I looked at her and said, "He had 30 people and $100 million, and I have a bachelor's degree and a MacBook." She said, "You know how much money he has? You got this. You're far more qualified than anybody else here. You'll figure it out." And I think that's sort of been the underlying thesis of digital and people in digital at that early stage of you'll figure it out. And so I did that on political campaigns for several years, moved to DC, worked for some super PACs before shifting over to Google. Worked inside the belly of one of the two beasts, where I worked across all of ad tech, really focusing on video and display, but doing sales for Google for about 3.5-4 years. Took that, went, got my MBA at the University of Oxford, where I studied the future of marketing at one of the oldest institutions in the world, which was a little bit of a fun
journey. Never heard of it.
Left there, did some consulting both before and after business school, and had a couple of really great experiences. Led growth as interim VP of growth for Bonobos, and took them through the acquisition to Walmart. And then was asked to join L'Oreal, where that was sort of my first beauty brand, my first big enterprise brand, and was brought on to help lead their in-housing of programmatic media. So bringing in, cutting the fat from the agency and bringing in-house as much as we could that made sense financially to B2B be closer to the brand. As we all know, the closer any media spend is to the brand, that's instead of outsource, typically the better it is, unless you find really great partners who effectively are an extension of your brand. And so did that for a couple of years, worked on and led CRM and data strategy for L'Oréal Paris, their largest brand. Ultimately became a brand marketer at L'Oréal, leading Feria hair color and taking that from high eight figures to mid nine figures, which was super helpful. I'm super grateful to be able to do that. Then left did agency for a couple of years, worked here in Austin for a great agency called GSD&M, a good mix of creative and media shop. And then now I'm at Beacon 1802, where I'm back to my beauty and really focusing on skincare.
You sound so nonchalant about your extensive background. That is very impressive. So bravo to you on sounding very humble, but I'll brag on you that going and looking at your LinkedIn, it's quite impressive, the brands and things that everybody that you just walked through. I'm curious.
Thank you, Cody. I feel like I have to stay humble because otherwise I just have to list out how old I am because I've been in this game for a while.
I'm curious how much you've seen, and especially since you've been in skincare, being at L'Oréal for a while and even at Bonobos, what you've seen the transformation of influencer marketing over your time.
Yeah, I think influencer marketing has gone from, I think really at its core, I remember, and to be fair, I'm a little biased. I grew up doing political campaigns in Utah. But I remember, I think the first influencer marketing I learned about were the Mormon mommy bloggers and really sort of blogger networks back on blogspot.com. It was sort of that first era of...
I thought you were going to say Mitt marketing. Romney for a second.
No.
We'll stay out of the political scene, but you keep going.
I'm not that old. Okay. But was really sort of that Mormon mommy blogger network and really mommy bloggers across the board, where I think influencer, for me at least, is where it first got to exposure for me. I think that was when it was more about the ad revenue that they were generating on site, so a great placement, but also they did really good at seeding products and talking to them and then building up relationships to try and get those dollars from brands. In a really, I think, meaningful and powerful way. And I think those same fundamentals that happened in the content creation of written word has extended now into photos from Instagram to videos and short form video and long form video across YouTube, TikTok, Reels, etc. So I think for me, it's really where it started and have worked with players in that space for a while. And I think what's really interesting about especially the D2C landscape and sort of the Twitter sphere of D2C that we met is how often nothing is new. It's the same tactic with new technology. Mm-hmm. It's the same, because I think at the core, it's still hitting on the human psychology aspect that drove it 10 years ago in a different format. I think I see that in terms of rebate programs, from a cashback perspective, an influencer. We see that in sort of just the evolution of ads and how we're changing the messaging. So I think to answer your question, really started there. Obviously, it's grown vastly. I think there was a dark spot for influencer marketing, sort of the bottom of the J curve, where it sort of spiked and then it dripped and then it came back up. I think I remember in business school, I was talking about how influencer marketing was dead after one of the Kardashians' boyfriends had posted Rob something Dyrdek. So
you're
horrible.
Really narrowing it down there.
I know. No.
Rob he's Dyrdek?
No, Scott Disick. Scott Disick had posted something that was clearly off-brand, off everything, taking the money and run, sort of was the sentiment. And I remember that was being used as the case study, like, influencer marketing is overpriced.
Yeah, you put copy in the caption, right?
Copy and paste and whatever the brand manager sent them or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a mishap. And look, those happen. This is not about him, but I think at that point, that was probably 2015, mm-hmm. I want to say. 14, 15. Influencer marketing is dead. Why are you paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for a celebrity to post this? And to be fair, people are still doing that. Alex Earle is $250,000 more in terms of getting a post from her. From what I understand in the market, we haven't gone that route. From a like paid campaign perspective. And I think that value exchange isn't really there anymore. That evolution has shifted. It shifted down market. It shifted into different economic incentives. It shifted in a lot of ways. At the end of the day, it's still word of mouth marketing. It's still, instead of listening to a brand voice, you're listening to a human's voice, an influencer's voice, someone who you might see as a friend from a parasocial relationship of an influencer. And I think that scale really helps determine that. So whether that is at a macro level, someone with 20 million, maybe down to 1 million followers, down another level into that 500,000 to 100,000, you get down into sort of that nano and micro level where the audience really knows that person and it really is that friend relationship. And I think all along that scale, you see opportunity for relationships with brands, for relationships in that influencer marketing. But I think that evolution at its core has remained consistent about, here I am with my daily life. This is what I use. It might work well for you. Link in bio. I think the evolution technologically of link in bio and how that has run has shifted. But at the end of the day, it's still that same core.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, I mean, back in the day, we've written a blog about this too. But even going back to like the Roman era, you see gladiators with the local olive oils of the day and age. So nothing's changed. It goes back forever. Influencer, there's always going to be some form of influencer marketing. I think this episode
I thought I was going back to ancient times with the Mormon mom. Yeah. I don't want that, me, Taylor.
Digital. But it goes to what you're saying, right? Just different platforms.
How often do you think about the Roman Empire, Taylor?
My wife surfaced that to me the other day. I was like, what is going on? What are you talking about? She was so pissed on the answer I gave. So we won't go there.
Today's Power Minute is brought to you by Social Snowball, an affiliate platform for e-com that is focused on enabling affiliate partnerships for what I like to call the modern affiliate. So not the traditional affiliates, publishers, blogs, etc. This is the modern affiliate, such as creators, ambassadors, influencers, customers, etc. So there's many things I love about Social Snowball. One of the first things that comes to mind is they eliminate all code leaks. So if your codes that have gone out to influencers or affiliates have ended up on coupon sites, Social Snowball would eliminate this. Also, it's very important to have a tiered-based system to motivate your affiliates to continue to post and generate revenue for you. So they make that super seamless. Make it super easy on the affiliate to get paid out any which way that they like. So Venmo, PayPal, directly to their bank on a Visa gift card, Amazon gift card, all that, etc. If you guys haven't checked them out, they're on the Shopify App Store. Go check them out today. You're missing out. They are clearly the best and our number one recommendation for affiliate marketing.
But I feel like this episode does have the opportunity to be juicy. You are our first guest that broke up with us. First guest that has broken up with us as a brand.
We're going to go there so early.
Could be a juicy title, but it's just interesting, right? So at one point, I remember I had posted something on Twitter about Beekman's results, and you had commented something along the lines of like, you buried the lead. You know, our cost per view is 10x cheaper than other influencer plays we've done in the past. 10x cheaper with COGS, kinship fees, shipping, all the above. 2 months later,
we broke up.
Yeah, we broke up. So, I mean, I'm just kind of jabbing a little bit, but like overall, feedback on,
I can do your right hook.
The feedback on your experience working with Kinship, you know, what led to the Hive highs, what led to the ultimate parting of ways. Curious to hear of your experience.
Yeah, I think it was in a lot of ways a success. I think as we look at some of those key metrics, absolutely a success. I think in terms of the campaigns we ran, being able to get the product in the hands of influencers, getting to see those posts, getting to see sort of what that return was really strong. I think where we were in a different spot, I think, than some brands is sort of where we wanted to be in that maturity curve and where we were in terms of our capital B big brand focus. I think we wanted to spend some time, especially on the content side from an ads perspective, leverage it in a different way. So I think to your point, Taylor, part of the math as to sort of why we went with Kinship was really, I think, the power you guys bring in content creation, in giving us those pieces of content from an ads perspective that we can run and test and build. And you and I have talked a lot about that. I think it's a really smart model. I think the types of ads that our brand wanted to focus on was not in that direction. And I think that piece falling out really shifted, I think, some of how we were thinking about our influencer strategy. I think overall we pulled back in a lot of ways so that we could have a little bit more focus as well. So we have some things that are being built and we're going to be launching here relatively shortly, but more so on a community aspect than on a seeding aspect. So I think part of it was a strategic shift from the top. I think as well, there was a larger focus on that quality for where we wanted to be from a branding perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But I think overall, like, enjoyed the experience. I think we did a lot of good work there. But yeah, you know, sometimes it's the relationship is just not perfect. But that doesn't mean we can't still be friends.
Good enough for you to be here today, and we appreciate you joining us. But just to clear up, obviously I know what you're saying loud and clear, but for the audience listening in here, when David says a certain level of quality to the content, so from seeding on behalf, like with the seeding efforts that we were able to do on behalf of Beekman, it lended itself to creative that may not be everything you dreamt of in a creative brief where they hit, you know, that first 3-second hook right on the money with those talking points delivered exactly how you'd like, or, you know, they showcase the product as they would in a commercial or in a studio shoot, exactly as you drew it up. And so some of the creative just didn't get through that internal approval hoop. And so that's what to set the clarity on defining
I think to put it another way as well, I think we are largely more focused on high fidelity quality of content. And I think a very strong strategy for a lot of brands is including lo-fi. A good mix of high fidelity and lo-fi. And I think it's something we wanted to test into, and it wasn't the right fit from some of our brand marketing side.
Yeah. And that makes complete sense.
Which is not about Kinship as a company, is about the media mix that you get from a seeding program, which I think is healthy and strong. And I think it is about that mix and where we want it to be.
For sure.
I mean, I've had similar discussions with some of our friends who love to make ugly ads. And I think, like, it's something where I think there's a lot of power in that concept. But I think that works for some brands. I think beauty and fashion, it's a little bit sometimes more challenging given the needs of the industry.
Yeah.
So just for clarity, the needs of the industry, in your opinion, are you tapping on that pool of people for the high fidelity content still with influencers and you're just shifting the strategy? Or is it, it's just a different pool of people, different like studio shoot, production shoot, bring in models, that type of thing. And that's how you're going to acquire that type of content.
I think it's a mix of both, and the connection's getting a little fuzzy. So if I misinterpret it, please stop me and let me know. But I think it is a mix of both. I think some of it is going to be that studio shot content. Some of it is going to be the in-house UGC style content. Mm-hmm. And some of it's going to be working with dedicated influencers who we have longer term contracts with. I think there's a good, healthy mix in that. But I think the way I'm at least thinking about it is the difference between human voice and brand voice. And then is it influencer created or brand created? And so I think if we look at that matrix, you have sort of human voice, influencer created is your classic influencer content. Brand voice, brand created is your classic high fidelity static ads. And then you have some stuff that is in that mix of human voice and brand created, where it is sort of that influencer style content, but it may be an in-house content creator. I think those three, it's important to have a good mix in your set. And then you can splice in high fidelity, low fidelity in one of those boxes if you want to take it on the Z-axis.
I still believe, I mean, we not still, but we've always believed that influencer can be that perfect middle ground to get the variety of both. Because even some of your content, like even reviewing it before we recorded, some of these reels are very high quality, professionally done, but you're also still getting the volume. And so a lot of times, like, people will come to us with, you know, you're not getting the cookie cutter content, but then they're also, they're doing that on their own and they're getting very limited number of assets versus the volume, where influencer as a pool of people, just as a general mechanism compared to the alternatives, kind of gives you that best of both worlds potential. Especially once you start getting into the mechanisms of creative briefs and what have you.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But I think what comes to mind is I think it's a Dilbert comic, actually, but it's in that style, but it's in the realm of, we want something that's never been done before. Cool. We bring you something that's never been done before. Where's the case studies on if this works or not? And I think that brands love to do both of those things. And as we push, I think it's about finding the right levers and where we push on certain things and where we choose not to. I think we were pushing in one element for our brand that I think is very valuable for many players in the industry. And for us, I think it had some intangibles that changed the game for us. So we pulled back.
Yeah, it's good. Well, we had passionate back and forth back in the day on this, but let's just to surface a hypothetical, or let's surface this to be, let's assume it's true until you push back. But if we were to launch every piece of creative that we sourced against a cost cap into your ad account, right, where cost caps supposedly what we believe to be the case is going to protect you on the downside protection, right? And Facebook's only going to deliver ad spend behind that creative. One, if it ultimately converts at your target CPA. And two, if Facebook believes that this piece of content will resonate well with the end viewer on behalf of your brand. And if it does not, no harm, no foul. It won't spend any money. The cost caps will limit that. If that is the case across all the content that we were able to receive, you personally, you call BS, that's silly, I don't believe that. Or maybe you do believe it and it's just too much of a pill to swallow to even just run this. Like, as someone sitting in your seat, I think it's really powerful to hear your two cents on that.
Ever wish someone could just look under the hood of your business and tell you what's working, but also what's quietly holding you back? And that's exactly what we do on our free consultation calls. We've helped generate over $300 million in revenue, audited 200 plus P&Ls, and generate hundreds of thousands of ad creatives at this point. And we do it all by delivering a proven system built to generate results across every stage of your D2C business, making sure that it's generating a financially beneficial return. So if you're ready to scale with clarity and confidence, book a free call now at kinship.co/contact-us. That's kinship.co/contact-us. We'll show you exactly how to unlock your next stage of growth. Now let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to challenge some of those assumptions to that early call out. So you got ahead of that one. But I think assuming all of that is true, I think it comes down to who you are as a brand. And I think I heard Moyes talk about it this way in terms of, like, caring about the capital B brand and brand building. And his point of view is, my brand is making money. Like, am I making more money? Great, that's the brand. And I think that is a very strong point of view to have. And I think that's where a lot of brands are. I think that's not where every brand is. I think for us, we want to do that and also present a particular brand image. And so I think it's sort of where we find that intersection is where I think it is. So I think for our brand right now, that's not the be all end all. It's very important, but I think as well, we are building our own capital B brand in some really strong ways. And I think we have to be pretty consistent on message in order to do that. I think that conversely, especially as you're starting out, especially as you're at a smaller size, like Moyes is right, especially for 6-7 figure brands, like your brand is making money. You don't have a brand unless you have people with the product in their hands. I think there comes a point in a maturity curve of our brand where that equation starts to shift a little bit, where people actually aren't buying the product, they're buying the brand. And look, part of that's probably influenced by my time at L'Oreal, where it is a parent company of a flagship number of brands who are built on brand. People buy L'Oreal Paris because they're worth it. Buy it because the product works, yes, because the word of mouth, et cetera, they try it. But they buy it because of what the brand believes in and what it stands behind in a lot of ways. There are also people who buy it on price. I won't deny that fact. But I think that legacy leaving brand, capital B brand, I think is where we're shooting for. And for that, we need to have a little bit tighter control around the messaging and around the fidelity. And so I think that's where we're trying to find that right lever. And so I think that to your point, to the underlying point, Taylor, of yours is, if this is all working and driving and we're protected from a financial perspective, yes, absolutely. But I think there are some intangibles at a certain maturity curve if that's not already who your brand is. And so we're a brand who's existed for a while and we're trying to firmly establish ourselves in a particular way. I think there's a little bit of a challenge with us adding this in this late in the mix versus starting here. So I think newer brands, absolutely, this makes a lot of sense as you're trying to grow, as you're trying to build and establish that. This can help find those right hooks, those right messaging. What is resonating with that audience may not come from you. It's going to come from your audience. And amplifying that, I think, is really powerful.
You think that's just macroly true across categories? Like, it's category agnostic, what you're saying? Or do you think that's specific to skincare, hair care, like things like cosmetics?
Yeah, I think certain categories are going to care about capital B brand than others, and certain companies as well. Like, I think I think there is a certain size. Like, let's look at the CPG space. Like, I think that any Unilever or P&G brand is going to care about their capital B brand because that's actually how they go from a dishwashing detergent that is basic to Tide that they both own, and they're able to trade off that difference, not because the formula is a buck more expensive, but because the brand is. And so I think that that element does at a certain size impact every brand. But I also think that that element is particularly true in brands that are selling beauty, not the industry beauty, but an image, fashion in particular, and beauty, cosmetics, etc. Like Hermes.
Yeah.
Is at a very different maturity point than Kate Spade, than a Target bag.
Yeah.
I think all three of those have a very different curve at which they want to be projecting themselves, and at the level of which capital B brand matters more than profits. And I think it's about finding the mix of both.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think to that point, like, for some brands, my brand is making money. And for some brands, their brand is, we'll issue money because we want to have the prestige or the luxury element.
I think that's where, and I think this is what you're servicing as well, C-Dub. When it's a luxury brand or a premium brand, hey, maybe seeding and repurposing the content you get from seeding doesn't make as much sense because it's lo-fi, it's raw. It makes it look like your product is in the hands of the everyday individual, right? And so for certain brands that are exclusive, premium, luxurious, it makes sense. Maybe you don't want that a part of the media mix because you don't want it to seem like it's in the everyday person's hands. Hey, this is an exclusive product. This is an elevated product. But I would say for the brands that aren't premium or trying to be premium, capital B brand, I do think seeding lends itself to, so like Procter & Gamble, I do think they should do seeding, honestly, and incorporate the lo-fi videos that they get that may not be perfectly drawn up A through Z, a part of their media mix. Because I think them being a little bit more relatable and adding a little bit more of a humanistic element into the media mix can impact their capital B brand in a positive way that gets the everyday individual bought into what they're doing as a brand.
I don't disagree, but I'd encourage you to rewatch Procter & Gamble, The Power of Moms, their Olympic spots, because I think that does a very good job at tying in that emotionality into the everyday user. But it's a very different type. It's a very different axis, I think. And so I think it's something where if I look at the broader industry and not just us, I think like there is a wide spectrum where seeding makes, I think seeding makes a lot of sense to get your product in the hands of as many people as you can. I think that alone makes a lot of sense because word of mouth marketing sells and always has since the beginning of time, to your point, Taylor. I think that is very powerful. I think the content you get out of that is going to shift in terms of how much you want to amplify that or not versus the rest of your mix. For sure. Us, the amount we wanted to amplify it didn't justify us continuing that seeding process.
Right. Because it was a contract play.
Correct.
Right. And I just to piggyback, to give an example, like, and Cody, we've had this internally, you may have seen it before onboarding, or you might've been pitched on it, but like M&M's is a perfect example, right? Household name brand, capital B is something they definitely care about. But when they incorporated kind of the content that we were able to source from our seeding efforts, those lo-fi, raw, non-scripted, really, I mean, year over year, from Father's Day to the previous year, 650% lift in sales when incorporating this content into the ad account. So just like a place for it, making it more relatable. It was amidst COVID. That is a product that literally is for everyone. It's not premium. It's M&M's at the end of the day. So like that could be an example where, hey, household name brand, maturity curve is way up there. It made a lot of sense for them to have it a part of the media mix.
Yep.
Bye. Let's get into some practicals as far as how this can be relatable to people that maybe have skincare brands that want to listen in. You're off the hot seat, David. that was really good.
Today's Power Minute is brought to you by Mighty Scout, an influencer tracking tool. So you've probably heard Taylor and I talk about Mighty Scout at length in past episodes, but today we want to take special time to speak to it specifically. So if you are investing in any sort of influencer marketing to a degree, I highly suggest getting on Mighty Scout. First of all, it's going to track all of your organic posting that goes out. So if you're doing seeding, pay for posts, you can drop in all your influencers by campaign. And then once those influencers are in those campaigns, they're going to immediately start being tracked if and when they mention you by handle or any hashtags that you give it. So it's going to give and pull all that content, most importantly, so that you can know who posted, you can reach out for content rights, etc. Also, it's going to give you all the reporting and ROI on those things as far as metrics wise. So you're going to be able to know the vanity metrics that go out around those influencer posts. You're going to know everything that it goes into around influencer marketing in regards to Mighty Scout. So if you haven't checked them out, highly, highly suggest them. Go to mightyscout.com to find out more.
What would you suggest starting out? Or let's just take like the 7-figure, 8-figure brand, what they're doing as far as skincare. Because I feel like there's actually a lot of copycat stuff that people do, especially in a category like cosmetics, where it just feels like everyone's kind of doing the same thing. So maybe you could speak to what you've seen. I mean, you have a lot of experience in this category, what you've seen done well, what you haven't seen done well, what you kind of are bringing into Beekman today. Yeah, I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I think you're showing a little naivety or dumbing it down a little bit, because the key word in beauty is dupe, not copycat. I think from a product level, we see that all the time. A brand will make a dupe product of a more prestige or luxury brand, because I think there's an opportunity to bring something that's very similar at a much reduced price point in beauty. You see that particularly with cosmetics. I think especially in mascara or lip, you see that a lot because it's about the color payoff, not about the like skincare benefit. Foundation, you don't see that as much because foundation, you're loyal to that. You know it doesn't break you out. You know how to work with it and blend it. That's a category where people are more loyal. But I do think you see across the industry, product-wise, a lot of dupe. I don't know if that's where you're going versus the marketing-wise. I think you also see a lot of lead and chase. I think anytime a brand does something new and innovative, I think you see a lot of people jump towards that. Of, oh, how did they get that to work? How can I make that work for me? I think I've seen that across the board in terms of, like, I've even been asked, how do we make our founder story go viral on TikTok, like Bobby Brown and Jones Road? And I think, like, there are elements to that where it's about the right moment, the right time, and the right message. But I think as well, it's about finding what works well for you, not necessarily for other people. I think the way I like to articulate this is you should be a better them, not a worse, a better you, not a worse them. And I think there are definitely elements you can learn from other players in the space in your own industry.
But so what has worked well for you
crosses that line is when you try and chase what someone else did because they did it. You don't even know if it worked. I think for us, what's worked well, I think really is focusing in on the benefit of the product. I think people really want to know, is this going to work for me? How does this work? We have a unique ingredient in our skincare that isn't really in most skincare. All of our skincare products are powered by goat milk. Goat milk has 34 active ingredients in it that are very nourishing to the skin and help reduce any sort of redness or skin sensitivity that you might have from your skincare. So when you apply and change out a serum and you start using retinol or you start using a new vitamin C, your skin needs to adapt to that. And oftentimes you can break out, you can have redness, you'll have a reaction to it. Goat's milk helps calm all of that irritation down. And so for us, it's about really educating on that. Does your moisturizer have 34 active ingredients as a provocative hook? I think we're testing different things there that really can drive that, but it is that ingredient forward, especially with this younger audience, as we think about Gen Z and millennials, very highly educated on skincare benefits. So they're actively searching for ingredients. They're looking for niacinamide. They're looking for ceramides. They're looking for bakuchiol. They're looking for vitamin C. They're looking for hyaluronic acid. And if you and your audience don't know what those are, I recommend looking it up. They're super powerful ingredients that are really good for your skincare. I think they're super very focused on SPF, and not only SPF, but is it sunscreen or is it SPF? What's the SPF level in it? Is it the SPF level that's tested by the US federal government or by Europe or by Asia? Because those have different levels of impact and power. And the consumer is very savvy on that regard. As far as leaning into that, leaning into the ingredient story, super powerful way for us to acquire new consumers and to educate them on our brand and the power of our brand.
So you're working with your influencers, explaining those benefits. That's really good. What percentage of marketing do you spend on influencer?
We spend probably about 15 to 20% of our overall marketing towards influencer in one way, shape, or form. So I think we have a decently healthy. in beauty, we see that across a wide range. We see that from 5% to 100%. Right. There are brands who all of their marketing is influencer. And I think like that varies based off of, again, where you are as a brand and your legacy. I think most of the brands that are 100%, that's how they started and that's where they've stayed because they've seen that work. Or they are backed by an influencer. So they're owned, the brand is owned by an influencer who's leveraging them and their own network. We see that a lot in the beauty space.
You said in some shape, form, fashion. What are the different shape, form, and fashions that you're investing in influencer marketing?
Yeah, I think for us, that is in the realm of affiliate influencer. That is in the realm of pay to post from like a celebrity perspective. That's in commission deals. That's in content generation, that we're paying influencers almost as if they're talent. So not for the influencer piece, but for their ability to communicate directly on camera. They know what resonates well with the type of audience we're going for. So I think a couple of different slices of how we break down that spend, but pretty solid across the board. We're spending a decent range there. I think there's always room to grow. I think we're testing into it more and more. I saw a great article the other day that showed, I think, the influencer industry is close to $30 billion of marketing spend right now. And that's been growing, and we see that continuing to grow. So I think we're starting to see where for us there is that return, and where we start to see that diminishing return, and because we're investing in the right ways.
And just a quick follow up on that: when repurposing, or just, you know, you're intentionally pursuing some of these creators for content specifically, how much of the budget allocation when your ad account is getting put towards this style of content in comparison to studio shoe assets, and how do they perform against one another for your brand specifically?
Yeah, I think it's a mix. I think we have studio shot content, we have static, and we have our influencer shot content. All perform really healthily. I think it's a good mix in our prospecting campaigns across all. So we are doing both Advantage Shopping and BAUs. We're testing in and out of those because we're seeing some fluctuations on what's working and what's not. But we're feeding that beast with a fair amount of that content across the board, pretty evenly distributed.
That's awesome. This is not a hot seat question, just a seamless transition here. When we had our content in there from seeding, how did that fare, or how did it perform before getting quickly shut down?
I think it was too early to tell, honestly. And I think that's probably one of the bigger misses on our end, is not giving enough room to have some of that data so we could have more of those conversations around what are we trading between brand and profit.
It's fair. I love it.
Last question here. What would be your piece of advice for someone that's trying to break into the skincare industry and wants to do influencer marketing in such a saturated space where probably every influencer has a different sponsor, a different product that they like? How are you breaking through?
Yeah, I think if you're a new brand doing that, I think it's going to be challenging. I think when we talk to especially some of the higher performing influencers, it's challenging in skincare. Because unlike a fashion product or a CPG product or an appliance or other things where you might have several, you really are only going to have one or two moisturizers. So how often can you get someone to change that? And those relationships, I think, are really impactful. So I think it is challenging over time to get there. I do think if you're starting out, seeding is a great way to do that. I think it's as we talked about earlier, get your product in the hands of as many people as possible to start talking about your product. I think from a gifting perspective, that's a very strong angle to go for. I think as well, the next level from that is affiliate. Start rewarding those people who you've been gifting so that they are encouraged and incentivized to speak more about that product and build that cycle. I think doing that at a more wider base of influencers that are more lower scale, so your 10,000 to 100,000 range influencers, is really impactful. So I think that's a great place to be.
People wanted to chat with you further, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on the Twitter sphere. I'm certain we'll link it in the show notes, but David Baker ATX.
We won't.
Find me on Twitter. Generally, I'm in more of the comments than I'm in posting my own content.
DMs are open.
DMs are open? In fact open. Okay. But I definitely get a lot of people hitting me up, cold pitching me on things. And please don't do that.
Can't imagine what's going to happen after this podcast goes live.
DMs might be closed by the time you hear this.
We're actually going to be DMing you after this episode to upsell you. So, all right, David. Well,
you know,
thank you so much.
We follow each other, so those DMs are always open.
That's right.
Thanks for the time, my man.
Of course.
A
All right, that's all for today. If you'd like some help developing your influencer marketing campaign, go ahead and DM us on Twitter. Links are in the description. Or you can head to kinship.co to learn more, and you can book a call there. That's kinship.co. At kinship.co, you also find tools, templates, and resources all designed to help you grow an influencer campaign that drives visibility and sales, not just likes. Thanks for tuning in, as always, and we'll see you next week.